Today's podcast of The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
If you have kids, you know it's hard to get them to eat right. Heck, it's hard for adults to eat fresh fruits and vegetables with every meal.
I love burgers and fries, yeah, and I love ice cream and cake, and so do most kids. And we're not talking about a lifestyle that excludes all that. The question is, how do we help people balance that out?
Maybe what the First Lady needs is a chorus of singing vegetables straight out of the Muppet Show.
And now, presenting my singing food!
We have an old-fashioned tomato.
Between overhauling healthcare and getting kids to eat broccoli, I kind of think the first task is the easier one.
Oh, I love my vegetables! How are you, cabbage?
Oh, getting ahead.
It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning. It's Tuesday, February 9th, and the takeaway for me is, you know, as hard as it is to get kids to change their eating habits, it's probably doubly harder for the adults in the family to do the same.
Well, in my house, you need more than a 60-vote majority to get kids to eat broccoli, that is for sure. Let's get right to the top stories we're following this morning. After talking about it for days, it's official. Toyota is now recalling over 400,000 Prius and other hybrid cars worldwide. Toyota president Akio Toyoda says the company is committed to fixing the braking systems on models that went on sale last year.
We will do everything in our power to regain the confidence of our customers.
But that Toyota in your garage may be losing value by the week. Juan Flores with Kelley Blue Book says the resale value for recalled Toyotas has dropped.
Anywhere between $200 and, say, $750.
More than 130,000 Prius hybrids and nearly 15,000 Lexus hybrids are part of today's U.S. recall.
John Murtha, the first Vietnam combat veteran to serve in Congress, died yesterday following complications from gallbladder surgery. Murtha, who was 77, represented a district in southwestern Pennsylvania known for its steel mills and coal mines. He wielded considerable clout for two decades as the ranking Democrat on the committee that oversees Pentagon spending. Pennsylvania Governor Ed Rendell says a big loss for the state.
He was our go-to guy, someone that whatever the issue was could weigh in and make things happen for us.
Murtha spent 36 years in Congress. We're going to have more on this later from our Washington correspondent, Todd Zwillick.
This morning, Iran says it has begun enriching uranium to a higher grade of 20%, which is far short of the 90% needed for nuclear weapons, yet it still increases fears that Iran is edging closer to producing a bomb. In Haiti, our partner, The New York Times, is reporting private medical evacuations of children to the U.S. have largely stopped. That's because aid workers and doctors are worried about being accused of kidnapping if they don't get the necessary paperwork, which is often slow to arrive or unavailable.
And later this morning, First Lady Michelle Obama is launching a nationwide campaign to fight childhood obesity. It's going to encourage more physical activity for kids, healthier foods in schools, and more accurate food labeling. We're joined now by Tony Geraci. He's the food service director for Baltimore City Schools. Tony, good morning.
Good morning.
How many kids do you serve every day?
83,000 plus hungry kids.
Okay, so, I mean, cafeteria food, not knowing for being all that delicious. So what's the best healthy entree you serve to kids?
Well, it's going to come off of our Meatless Monday menus. We do a baked lasagna served with like a romaine lettuce salad and fresh fruit, or the baked eggplant parmesan also served with like steamed vegetables and fresh fruit.
Eggplant parmesan for children. We're going to talk more to Tony Geraci in just a moment. Check in the markets. Asian markets are mixed. European indices up. Futures are up as well. The Dow will start at 9,908. The S&P opens at 1,056 and the NASDAQ at 2,126.
Thinking about Valentine's Day, we're going to talk about love in the workplace, complications and joys. And we're also going to be talking about the First Lady's fight against childhood obesity. Tell us your stories and diet sins at 8778MYTAKE or post it to our website, takeaway.org. Why is it hard to lose weight? More on Michelle Obama and childhood obesity in just a few moments.
Do you have kids? When they wake up, ask ask them?
Are you asking me?
I'm not asking you. I know how many kids you have.
And my kids eat eggplant parmesan, by the way.
So does my kid.
I love it.
But for most kids, when your kids wake up in the morning, ask them what their favorite food is.
They got pralines and cream, and they got Mississippi mud, and they got chocolate eruption, and they got grape. They got grape. And super chocolate.
That is Chunk from the movie The Goonies. You'll notice he didn't mention Brussels sprouts ice cream or cranberry ice cream, although cranberry sorbet is delicious. So we all know, we've heard the news reports for years now, Americans are fat. In fact, 2/3 of U.S. adults and almost 1 in 3 kids are overweight or even obese. That increases your risk for diabetes, heart disease, lots of other chronic illnesses. And because healthcare and the Afghan war were so easy to tackle, the White House is now taking on junk food. So today the First Lady unveils what's called Let's Move. And it's an administration-wide campaign to fight childhood obesity.
Others have tried.
Exactly. Joining us now, Arkansas Surgeon General and practicing pediatrician Joe Thompson. He's the director of the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation Center to Prevent Childhood Obesity. Good morning, doctor.
Good morning.
And Tony Geraci joins us again. He's the food service director for Baltimore City Schools. Good morning.
Good morning.
Dr. Thompson, we've been hearing these reports for years. It hasn't seemed to alarm anyone over much, parents anyway, and we haven't seen childhood obesity going down. And yet you have some amazing statistics, and you've actually have reports from people who are saying that childhood obesity is a threat to our national security. What makes this such an important issue?
Well, I think this decade we have recognized how much our children have gained weight over the last 3 decades, and we're starting now to see the impact of adult diseases in earlier and earlier ages. It really represents a threat not only to the future well-being of our families and communities, but also of our workforce, and that's why it has become such a critical issue.
Well, there's there's a number of different causes for why a child could be overweight. I mean, it could be a huge number of things, but it's most likely not genetics.
That's absolutely correct. We've seen this epidemic blossom over the last 3 decades, and your genes don't change that quickly. It really is basically because our kids are eating far more calories than they need, and they're not burning off as many by being physically active.
Tony Geraci, you serve, as you said, 85,000 students or so per day in the Baltimore City Schools?
Yeah, that's right.
And that's more than 200 schools that you cater to.
Correct.
So you bring these kids in. I'm sure a lot of them aren't happy that they're eating in the cafeteria anyway. How do you get them to eat something healthy? I mean, how do you get 85,000 kids to eat eggplant parmesan?
Well, look, the population that I serve are largely underprivileged, and the meals that they get at school are probably the only real meals that they're going to get every day that are consistent. So what we try to do is we try to offer up better choices for our kids. 1 in 3 kids born after the year 2000 are going to get type 2 diabetes, and 1 in 2 African-American kids are going to get this disease. And the good doctor is right. This is going to devastate our country in the next 20 years.
Dr. Thompson, you come from Arkansas. Arkansas, I think, is number 2 on the states that are most overweight. How have you dealt with this in your own state as Surgeon General there?
Well, I think we, like other southern states, and as your other guest mentioned, lower income communities have an extra added risk from the obesity. We've really taken an approach to try to change the environment that kids live, learn, and play every day, trying to improve the cafeteria offerings in the school, trying to increase the level of activities both within the school and changing the environment around the school so that kids can walk and bike again. And we're raising awareness so that parents actually recognize the risk and can take some simple steps that over time will make a lasting change.
Okay, but parents themselves have trouble losing weight, and I imagine they would then have trouble getting their kids to. And, you know, you also, Mike Huckabee, quite famously tried to, as a politician, set an example, as a politician, set policy that would help change people's healthy eating habits, and that didn't exactly work. How do you do that as a policymaker?
Well, I think it will take the actions of all policymakers. We have continued many of the programs and are trying to expand those now under a Democratic governor, and we're seeing a flattening, a halting of the obesity epidemic. But we've got to have change at the federal and the local levels working in concert if we're going to be able to reverse reverse this epidemic.
So, Tony Gerace, do you have kids?
Yeah, I have three kids, in fact.
Okay, so as you said, if these kids are coming to school and it's one of their only meals, that's not a solution for their entire eating habits. What do you think is your one piece of advice in order for parents to deal with childhood obesity?
Well, I think to try to get better choices in front of their kids. Our kids today live in this world of portion distortion. They've been supersized for so many years and so many generations now that kids don't even understand what a real portion is. I had a group of high school kids in my office a couple of weeks ago talking about wanting more food. I think education is the key. I think we've got to sit down and start having real conversations about food.
Okay, Dr. Thompson, what's the one piece of advice you could maybe give to First Lady Michelle Obama that would actually work?
Well, I would ask her and more importantly, everyone across the nation to really challenge to become much more aware of your environment. I mean, employers need to look at what's in the vending machines, the opportunity for us to see where grocery stores are not so that families could actually have access to healthier foods. These are all things that we can take on with policy change to make the healthy choice become the easy choice.
Well, it's not exactly easy to change an entire family's eating habits. And Tony Gerace, if you're handling the kids because they're a captive audience in your cafeteria, do you ever reach out to parents and try to change what they're doing at home?
Yeah, absolutely. We have a lot of parent engagement, and we're working with parents now around healthier choices and trying to create opportunity for fresh food in neighborhoods that, quite honestly, are food deserts.
And the answer to those who say it's too expensive to eat healthily would be that, Tony Gerace, you serve meals for about $2.75 per kid, so I guess it is affordable. Tony Gerace is the food service director for the Baltimore City Schools. He serves about 85,000 kids a day. Dr. Joseph Thompson, Surgeon General of Arkansas and director of the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation Center to Prevent Childhood Obesity. It's 15 minutes past the hour. Let's check in now on the headlines.
Toyota is now officially recalling more than 400,000 of its Prius and other hybrid vehicles worldwide. Company President Akio Toyoda gave the details.
We submitted the recall notifications in regard to four models. The Prius, the Prius plug-in hybrid, the Sai, and the HS250H. The notifications are in regard to the braking system employed on those models.
This recall is in addition to the previous recalls on other models because of those faulty gas pedals. In Connecticut, authorities have opened a criminal investigation into the causes of an explosion at a power plant. Middletown Police Chief Patrick McMahon says officials have a warrant to investigate the site.
Although intentional criminal acts have been ruled out, we have not ruled out criminal acts of negligence, and therefore until that search warrant has expired, it is a crime scene and is treated as such.
Sunday's explosion killed five people.
Michael Jackson's Dr. Conrad Murray appeared in Los Angeles court yesterday. He's been charged with involuntary manslaughter. Conrad Murray has been released on bail, however. If convicted, he could face up to 4 years in prison. And finally, for fans in New Orleans, the Super Bowl victory party will continue today. The Saints will be honored with a parade this afternoon, beginning with their home turf, the Louisiana Superdome. Those are some of the stories that we're watching this morning. Coming up, we're looking ahead all week to the 2010 Winter Olympics.
I'm hoping that people feel like they're part of the skating world again, and we haven't had that in the United States since Nancy and Tanya.
That self-described princessy skater, Johnny Weir. We're going to have a profile of him in just a few minutes.
Hey, you want that to go?
Our first news takeout this morning is an obituary and also a discussion of a coming changing of the guard in the Congress, the House, and the Senate. Congressman John P. Murtha from the 12th District of Pennsylvania died yesterday at the age of 77 after suffering complications from gallbladder surgery. He made headlines shortly after the onset of the Iraq War, really in the mid-2000s, when he called for the war to end, that the future of our country cannot sustain the Iraq War, and he spoke publicly about it.
Our military is suffering. The future of our country is at risk.
We cannot continue on the present course. It is evident that continued military action in Iraq is not in the best interest of the United States of America.
John Murtha, who died in complications from a gallbladder surgery yesterday. Takeaway Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick has covered Congressman Murtha for all the time you've been on Capitol Hill. Here was somebody from the Vietnam generation who had a long rise and then a difficult sort of end game.
Yeah, that's right, John. Jack Murtha, a 19-term congressman and former Marine colonel. And one of the old guard of the Vietnam era, as you mentioned, there are still plenty of Vietnam vets left in Congress, but Murtha was one of the most influential. I want to paint a picture for you quickly of the House chamber, just to give you a sense of how Murtha operated. He was famous for it around Congress. There's no assigned seating in the House of Representatives. Members sit wherever they want. But in the back corner, in the back row on the right-hand side, there's a little area that's informally known as the Pennsylvania Corner. Huh. And that's where members from Pennsylvania go to chat. It's just an informal place. And this area is known because Jack Murtha was always found there. If you wanted to find Jack Murtha during any given vote, you look in the back row in the corner, and there was Murtha holding court. Members gathered around him, sometimes passing notes, coming for advice, coming for discussions from both sides of the aisle. And they did it for a couple of reasons. One, 19 terms. The guy knew where the bones were buried. He was a very senior member. But also, as a senior appropriator, he controlled all of the spending at the Defense Department, not to mention all those thousands and thousands of earmarks. And that's how Jack Murtha did business. He controlled so much of the pet money that members needed to bring back to those bases in their districts. And they came to see Murtha because, as everyone knew in Congress, Jack Murtha gaveth and Jack Murtha tooketh away. Everyone knew it, and that's why they came to see him in the Pennsylvania corner.
But ironically, it was Murtha's proximity to that Pentagon largesse that was in some sense his undoing. He could have been majority leader, but it didn't make it.
He came very close. When Nancy Pelosi reached the speakership after being House Minority Leader for so many years, she backed Jack Murtha to be Majority Leader. He lost. And you're right, John. Part of the reason he did was his proximity to earmarking some scandals that have affected a lot of lobbying firms. Now, we have to stress that Jack Murtha was never convicted of any crimes or even charged. I got to take you back to the Belushi era of Saturday Night Live, almost 1980, the abscam, FBI sting.
Well.
Yeah, where several members of Congress took bribe money from who they thought was a corrupt Arab sheik, a Saudi sheik. Turns out it was an FBI informant in a beard. Jack Murtha never took a bribe, but he was in the room, and he was never charged, but he was implicated.
You know, it occurred to me yesterday that this Vietnam generation in the House and the Senate, it has an interesting legacy. I mean, you've got Murtha, you've got Kerry, a combat veteran, John Kerry, Bob Kerry, combat veteran.
Right.
You got John McCain, combat veteran.
Right.
But both Kerry and McCain also ran for the president. Ironically, the draft dodgers, Clinton and George W. Bush, who was in the National Guard, got to the White House. The combat veterans didn't make it. Cheney got 5 deferments and made it to be one of the most powerful vice presidents in U.S. history. What is the legacy here?
Well, look at Randy Duke Cunningham, a famous Vietnam ace pilot, powerful member of Congress who went to jail for corruption just a couple of years ago. It's an interesting way to look at it, John. Jack Murtha, again, a Marine colonel. He was the first Vietnam veteran elected to Congress, and some of the Iraq veterans and newer veterans who are getting elected now look to him as a mentor, people like Patrick Murphy of Pennsylvania, who is an Iraq veteran. You're right that a lot of the combat veterans never made it to the very top. Murtha himself, as he said, almost reached majority leader, but not quite, but he wielded enormous power in the House. He wielded the kind of power you don't see, the behind-the-scenes money power.
And McCain still does, we should say. Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent, talking about a coming changing of the guard there with the passing of John Murtha.
And now to our sports takeout with Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen. The Super Bowl is over and we're moving on to the 2010 Olympic Games. And we have a profile today of someone who, if nothing else, he sparks discussion around his sport. That's pro figure skater Johnny Weir. Ibrahim, Johnny Weir is known for his outlandish costumes. Not only that, but what he says, he's kind of outspoken in what he says. That's how he's become sort of a focus of media attention.
Well, just to get a sense of who Johnny Weir is, he's the ultimate commander on the ice and in defending his sport. Listen to what he had to say to ESPN's Jim Capel.
That's why people don't necessarily think it's a real sport, is because it looks easy. We're not out there tackling or being tackled or checked or running excessively. It looks effortless and beautiful and graceful and all these things, but you know, I would challenge any football player or baseball player, well, especially baseball players. I mean, how you can be 300 pounds and play a sport and get paid millions of dollars to do it, I'll never know.
So Johnny Weir is a three-time national champion, and he's a former world bronze medalist. But he hasn't won gold at the Olympics, and that's what this Olympics is about for Johnny Weir, to prove that.
Well, he missed his bus, famously, didn't he? When he was supposed to skate, he went out to go catch the bus, and the bus schedule had changed, and he didn't know it, and he didn't make it on time.
And for those moments, he gets an incredible amount of attention. In 2007, the movie Blades of Glory was built around his life.
That's right.
He's got a show on the Sundance.
Not flattering.
Yeah. And he's got a show on the Sundance Channel. But I think what's important about him is that he challenges the gender binary. He kind of pushes the boundaries. You don't really know which way he's coming from, but you have to acknowledge that he's an incredibly gifted athlete.
At the
age of 12, he did an axel on his first week on skates, and his coach is like, "How did you learn how to do that?" And he said, "I just watched it on TV." So if anything about Johnny Weir is that he is incredibly gifted, and he is definitely a person to watch.
And he is a fierce competitor,
indeed,
as you said. Thanks so much, Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, our Takeaway Sports contributor. Coming up, we're going to be talking about what the president wants to do to get some agreement on health care.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Coming up this morning, we'll talk more about how both sides can come together on passing a health care bill. The tactics carry a lot of risk, more in a few minutes. Right now, let's check in on top news stories at 30 minutes after the hour. The wave of bad news continues for Toyota. This morning, the company officially recalled over 400,000 Prius and other hybrid cars worldwide. The problems with the braking system affects more than 130,000 Prius hybrids and nearly 15,000 Lexus hybrids sold in the United States last year. Toyota President Akio Toyoda says he may come to the U.S. next week to explain the massive recalls, which cover nearly 9 million cars total.
Let me assure everyone that we will redouble our commitment to quality as a lifeline of our company, with myself taking the lead.
This morning, the Washington Post reports that State Farm, the nation's largest auto insurer, warned federal regulators about problems with Toyotas as far back as 2007. This morning, Iran says it has begun enriching uranium to a higher grade of 20%, which is far short of the 90% needed for nuclear weapons. Yet, it still increases fears that Iran is edging ever closer to producing an actual bomb. In response this morning, Defense Secretary Robert Gates says it wants the United Nations Security Council to approve a resolution in weeks, not months, that would impose new sanctions against Iran.
If Iran continues and develops nuclear weapons, it almost certainly will provoke nuclear proliferation in the Middle East. This is a huge danger.
China, in the Security Council with a veto, remains opposed.
Here at home, Washington, D.C. is bracing for another foot or more of snow today, even as residents continue to dig out from that blizzard over the weekend. And the White House wants to know why Anthem Blue Cross, California's largest for-profit health insurer, is raising premiums by almost 40%. Health and Human Services Secretary Kathleen Sebelius has asked the company to provide justification, considering it made nearly $3 billion last quarter alone. Let's check on the markets. Asian markets are mixed. European indices are up. Futures are up as well. The Dow will start at 9,908. That's the first time since last November that it's opened at under 10,000. The S&P starts at 1,056 and the NASDAQ at 2,126. Those are some of the stories that we're following this morning.
So the future of health care reform on Capitol Hill, well, the president has a plan. And on the one hand, it sounds completely reasonable, inviting congressional leaders from both parties to the White House to get people together to attempt to find some sort of common ground. Here he is speaking about what his intentions are, talking to the Democratic National Committee fundraiser in Washington last Thursday.
What I'd like to do is have a meeting whereby I'm sitting with the Republicans, sitting with the Democrats, sitting with health care experts. And let's just go through these bills, their ideas, our ideas. Let's walk through them in a methodical way so that the American people can see and compare what makes the most sense.
We do have a name for that. It's called Congress and the White House. That's what they're supposed to be doing. But, of course, the failures on health care reform motivated the president to do something with cameras rolling. Is it a high-stakes game or is it utterly reasonable and really the only way to move forward on health care reform right now? We've asked David Herzenhorn, congressional correspondent for The New York Times, to join us. Good morning, David.
Good morning.
Haven't talked to you for a while. You know, this seems to me to be both kind of standard issue Obama, but also certainly a departure from relying on Congress to actually deliver a bill. Which is it?
Well, look, you know, right now they don't have the votes in Congress. So if you want to pass a bill, you better do something. And the president is trying to send messages to a lot of folks, to lawmakers, to voters, that he's not giving up on this. And yet, as you point out, you know, there's one place where the debate matters, and that's on the floor of each chamber in Congress. And in the Senate, the Democrats have a problem. They can't get past a Republican filibuster.
Now, let me push back a little bit on this, and you can throw water all over me if you like. What is the chance that this will actually produce a compromise bill versus just making a lot of campaign videos for Republicans who will be seen standing up to the president who's trying to force something down the Americans' throats?
Well, you know, look, this could go both ways, right? I mean, the president might be creating a situation where he offers some political cover to Democrats to do what they need to do to move, you know, a bill in expedited fashion through the Senate under a budget reconciliation process that would need only 51 votes. Remember, 51 votes is still a majority of the Senate as opposed to the filibuster, which
right,
needs
right.
40 votes to stop it. So, you know, both sides are jockeying for position here. The chance of a bipartisan compromise bill, there seems to be very little of that. Colleague Robert Parr and I wrote about the Republican ideas in the newspaper this morning, and you should see the hate mail that's coming in from Democratic-leaning readers.
Well,
you don't even want to read about those ideas. Yeah.
Well, you know, the question of where the GOP is on having a sort of theoretical health care reform bill of its own is really sort of all over the map. Here's Lamar Alexander on the floor last month responding to a rhetorical question he sort of assumes Democrats are asking, which is, what are Republicans waiting for here? Listen.
They'll be waiting a long time for the answer to that. If they're waiting for the Republican leader, Senator McConnell, to roll into the Senate a wheelbarrow filled with a 2,700-page Republican comprehensive health care bill.
Now, David Herzenhorn of The New York Times, it seems as though Lamar Alexander is suggesting there that there is no policy behind the GOP, that it's really just a tactic. Do you agree with that?
Well, they've taken a careful approach here, right? The Democrats are in the majority. The Democrats set the agenda. And their point, the Republican leader Mitch McConnell as well, has said, look, we don't want to do a big, comprehensive, you know, system-wide overhaul. They want to go more of a step-by-step approach. Now, there are experts who will say that that won't get you where you need to go. That won't control health care costs. It won't cover the tens of millions of people who are uninsured. On the other hand, there's a lot of apprehension, as we've seen in polls, among Americans about so much change so fast.
And it does seem as though Congress is willing to, you know, where you need to go is simply get some doable bill out of the House and Senate. If they do something that is, in theory, doable here, what are we likely to see? What is doable? What sort of compromise could actually produce some kind of health care change?
Well, you know, the two sides certainly agree on some small things, like extending dependent coverage for adult children who get out of college. They're not in the job market necessarily yet, or in a job market where they have benefits. So, you know, allowing adult children to stay on their parents' policies till age 25 or 26 is something both sides agree on. In theory, they both agree on trying to figure out a way to stop insurance companies from denying coverage based on pre-existing conditions. The Republicans, however, are finding it hard to get that into a limited proposal. Obviously, if you want to cover everybody, you need to have healthy people in the risk pool along with sick people, or it's just not affordable. So, you know, there are bits and pieces where they agree in theory of selling insurance across state lines, something that Republicans have long called for. The Democrats say they want to do the same thing. The question is, do you tighten federal regulation so that insurance companies just don't pick the state with the weakest regulations to be the one where they write their policies with the minimum levels of coverage? So that, you know, they're even on in areas where they agree, like something like, you know, selling insurance across state lines, they go about it in very different ways.
Well, David Hertzenhorn, congressional correspondent for the New York Times, talking about new tactics, a new approach to health care reform by the Obama administration, going public, convening a summit, and trying to talk about where the common ground is. Thank you, David. Coming up, we're going to talk about work, and every Tuesday, this is, you know, I mean, Valentine's Day is coming up, right? So check this out.
Grab a cup of coffee and squint across the table. Oh, my God, it's the Corporate Clark Gable.
It's a serious issue. HR deals with it all the time. Valentine's Day is in the air. Office romances, do they make people better workers? How serious of an issue is it in the workplace? We'll talk more later this hour. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Celeste Headlee. Well, Iran has announced that it is enhancing and expanding its nuclear program. The United States and France have said there's no alternative but strong new international sanctions against Iran. And in fact, the U.S. Defense Secretary Robert Gates says that Iran has rejected any overtures from Western countries, and a collective international will, he says, is needed to find a peaceful way to resolve the issue. The French foreign minister actually says that Iran's latest moves amount to blackmail. We're joined now by the BBC's John Lyne. He's our man in Iran, and he joins us from London. John, good morning.
Good morning.
What exactly are these newest pronouncements from Iran saying that they're rich in uranium, but not to the point at which they'd need to make a nuclear weapon? What exactly do they amount to?
Well, they're stepping up enrichment from the level which you need to make fuel for a normal nuclear plant, 3.5 to 5%, which you can't use to make weapons, up to 20%, which you still can't use to make weapons. But it gets closer, and it's much quicker. If you had a 5% uranium in a stockpile, which Iran does, it would take a couple of years to turn that into weapons grade. That is, with all the ifs and buts, and you kick out all the inspectors, and you create that fast. But in theory, in a couple of years, they could produce a bomb.
So what
now,
is it?
If they then have a stockpile of 20%, they could then, from that material, make a bomb in maybe as little as 6 months. It makes it a very dangerous situation.
So what does Iran say that their purpose is?
Well, they're talking about providing fuel for a Tehran research reactor, which they say produces much-needed medical isotopes. I think the rest of the world is pretty sceptical and really thinks this is more of a bluster, really, because most experts think it would be very difficult for Iran, although it may be able to produce the 20% fuel, it won't be able to turn it into workable fuel rods, which would actually be useful in that plant.
Hey, this is the Defense Secretary Robert Gates speaking from France.
The key is persuading the Iranian leaders that their long-term best interests are best served by not having nuclear weapons.
How does one do that? How does one convince the Iranian government that they are best served by not having nuclear technology?
Well, the point is to convince them that to have a program, I think, that is clearly civilian and has enough guarantees, because the outside world insists that they don't have a problem with Iran having civilian technology, but they want more guarantees. The problem at the moment is that the Iranian government is not very susceptible to outside pressure. The real pressure on President Ahmadinejad is coming domestically from the opposition, who are going out in the streets again on Thursday, particularly from hardliners in his inner circle. So if he gives any sign of compromise, he just gets more trouble. So at the moment, it's really not worth his while compromising, even if he faces tough new sanctions.
Well, what kind of tough new sanctions would he be facing? What else do they have to threaten him with?
Well, there's some proposals going around the United Nations, particularly some interesting financial sanctions, including sanctions on the Iranian Central Bank, which, if they'd gotten through the UN, could be quite tough. But they got the problem of convincing China, and that is a big problem at the moment.
Who could veto any sanctions that they want to put forward, any at all?
That's right. They could veto, or they could water the sanctions down to make them almost meaningless.
Okay, that's John Lyne. He's the BBC reporter from Iran. Thank you so much. Good morning. I'm Celeste Headlee here with John Hockenberry. And coming up, we're going to talk about workplace romance. For a long time, it's been considered to be a no-no, sometimes unspoken. But turns out having a romance at work actually could work for you in terms of your career. Did it?
So my wife and I met at ABC News.
And it worked for a couple other people we have with us on the show. We're also talking
ABC News isn't doing so well.
Didn't work out for ABC News, that's correct. But I think that wasn't with, you know.
No.
No relation. We're also talking about First Lady Michelle Obama. She is starting her battle against childhood obesity. But if you've ever gone on a diet, you know that eating healthy and exercising is a lot harder than it sounds. So we want to make it personal, not just for your kids, but you too. If you've lost weight, what's your one tip you would give to others? And what's part of the reason it's hard for someone to lose weight? What's yours? Don't be ashamed. Just give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Post it to our website, also thetakeaway.org. First, let's take a check on leading stories at 48 minutes past the hour. First Lady Michelle Obama, as we said, launching a campaign to fight childhood obesity today. She tells ABC News what she envisions for young Americans.
They're enjoying their food. They're eating their vegetables. They're doing their running and walking and playing and still, you know, have time to get a good fun meal in every once in a while. That's the life that, you know, I'm hoping that we can build for Americans.
To do that, the First Lady wants healthier foods and more physical activity for kids and better food labeling. Democratic Congressman John Murtha of Pennsylvania is being remembered on Capitol Hill today for being the voice of veterans. Yesterday, Murtha died of complications from gallbladder surgery. He was 77. And it's now official. Toyota is recalling more than 400,000 Prius and other hybrid cars worldwide. It's time to fix those brake problems, and this is the second major recall by the automaker. Around 130,000 of the latest recalled cars are in the U.S.
Disturbing story out of Haiti. The United Nations says it will cut off shipments of free medicine to hospitals that are charging patients for the same medicine after learning some treatment centers were hitting patients with fees. Authorities made the decision to make all medical care free following January's earthquake. So yesterday, the Dow Jones Industrial Average fell below 10,000, in part because of the impact of European debt issues. Greece in particular, struggling to deal with its heavy debt, certainly not the only country. It's putting pressure on the euro and making investors very nervous around the world. For the latest, we're joined by Andrew Walker, business correspondent for our partner, the BBC from London. Good morning, Andrew.
Good morning, John.
So what is the threshold here? There's a lot of worry. There's a lot of tiptoeing. But it seems to me that there's a straw that broke the camel's back somewhere in the future here. What do you think?
It's certainly there is a growing concern in financial markets that Greece might default on its debt. And I think you're right. It'd been around for many months. But curiously, it was those events in Dubai late last year that started making markets very much more sensitive to the prospect of something unpleasant happening. But, you know, attention has very much moved on from Dubai and is now really focusing on southern Europe. First and foremost, Greece. Portugal is also a possible issue, and Spain as well. All three of those are regarded as significant risks now in financial markets.
And with the U.S. and Japan with huge debts as a, you know, fraction of their GDP, you know, it seems as though it could come from anywhere. And that's the uncertainty that really is roiling the markets right now.
Yeah, that's certainly true, although I think it's fair to say that for the foreseeable future, the markets do not have any great doubts about the ability of either the United States or Japan, or even, I say this slightly with slightly less conviction, Britain, to service what are very large debts. The real concern especially is Greece, and they're looking increasingly to see whether there's going to be some kind of bailout, coordinated perhaps by other members of the European Union or possibly even from the International Monetary Fund.
Reassuring news from Andrew Walker for the first time in a while, business correspondent for our partner, the BBC. Thanks for that. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
A lot of people, when they start their jobs, they get a great big employee handbook. John, did you read the employee handbook, the whole thing?
Oh, sure I did. Yes, every single word.
Yeah, you probably
word.
Didn't. But you may not know that there's a national organization, actually, for human resource workers. Did you know this? They
conduct what's called
a romance survey.
Hmm.
And in the last romance survey, 72% of employers say they do not have a written policy about dating in the office. 14% say they have an unspoken policy that everyone just kind of understands. And here's maybe an even more surprising fact. Most HR managers say marriage is the most common end result of workplace romances. And they even say that studies show a higher level of productivity from dating couples on the job. So every time we want to talk about work, we, of course, talk to Beth Kobliner, our work contributor. She's here to explain all of this and some of the difficulties, challenges, and maybe benefits of dating on the work.
We're also going to date our way out of this recession. Is that what you're saying, productivity-wise?
I doubt it, but it's an idea. We're also joined by a happily married couple who met at work, Shelley and Kevin Shanoy. Am I pronouncing that right?
Yes.
Welcome.
Yes.
Good morning.
Good morning. Hi.
Beth, let's look at this historically, because in the 1990s, we saw some kind of draconian policies. Dating at work was really frowned on.
Right.
Well, it's interesting that you talk about, you know, when you match it up with the recession, it's the first time we've gotten some heartening news. And a Vault.com informal study just is coming out tomorrow that showed that when you look at the recession, 70% of people say that despite bad economic times, it hasn't affected their willingness to take a risk and plunge into love in the workplace. So I guess that's the heartening news, that despite bad times, people are still willing to take a risk. But you're right. You know, the last few years, we have seen a growing acceptance of work in love in the workplace. In fact, if you look at people today in their 20s, about 30% say they have had a romance in the workplace, where if you look at people today in their 40s and you ask, have you ever had a romance in the workplace? Only 17% say they ever have had that. So I think there's a shifting, you know, acceptance of what's okay. And most polls these days say 40 to 60% say of people say, yes, I've had some sort of romantic relationship in my workplace. And 30% claim that that has led to some sort of partnership or marriage.
Okay, well, that's a lot of numbers, but yeah. We have in us the actual real result of these numbers. Shelley and Kevin, that's right. You guys met on the job.
Yes.
And you're working for an international banking corporation. How did this kind of get started? Were you actually dating while you were working together?
No, I was dating someone else I was working with at the same job. So, yeah, and you were dating someone else, sort of.
Yeah, I think...
we got to get into this international banking thing.
We also were working in a very old group, so we were like some of the only like young people that we had met. So it was kind of cool to meet someone of our age bracket.
True, but I was actually dating someone on my team, which was seriously frowned upon. So that was like this big secret.
But you and Kevin were in different departments.
But then we were sort of in the related departments, I guess. But we were openly flirting at work because I was already hiding a different relationship.
Well, was there a negative reaction if you were openly flirting where people notice it? There was.
I think for her, we were discussing this before, and for me, I got like a little, you know, my coworkers would give me
memo.
Sounds
like a reality show.
Yeah. So it was kind of more acceptable for you to be flirting Kevin than for Shelley.
Yeah, I straight up got pulled aside and reprimanded.
And it's interesting because there was a study that came out last year that showed that it can be especially damaging for women. It's unfair but true. Women tend to be judged more harshly in these kind of situations. And it seems that, you know, when you – on the outward, it sounds like a great thing. You meet somebody in the workplace. But there are a lot of pitfalls that people have to be careful
Okay, so how do you avoid them? What's the best way to handle this?
Well, first of all, the big no-no – and these guys did it and they seem to be okay – but dating somebody who is your boss or your, in this case, he wasn't your boss,
No. But
somebody who, if you're an employee, for example, the U.S. Army bans outright the idea of dating a superior.
Right.
UPS bans outright. If you're an employee, an hourly employee, you shouldn't be dating a supervisor.
Because of harassment cases.
Absolutely. But other workplaces, they have these love contracts or, you know, various rules. So you want to know your company's rules.
And there's Letterman.
Then there's Letterman. Exactly. Oh, yeah. Okay. And then you get into the situation of other workers being upset that, oh, well, he's dating her and she's getting preferential treatment with the Letterman case. She's going on the air more. So are people upset that that person's getting... So they're all kind of state laws, federal laws, and workplace laws.
You should probably
read that handbook.
Shelley and Kevin, what advice do you give to somebody who's met somebody on the job that they want to go out with, but they don't want to quit their job in order to date that person?
Be ready to keep a lot of secrets.
Be discreet.
Yeah, you gotta be discreet. Don't be an idiot. I mean, don't flaunt anything. Don't make anything obvious. You've gotta try to hide it.
You're not saying don't be an idiot like I was. Is that what you're saying?
Yes. I didn't want to say that.
That's the takeaway. Don't be an idiot, which actually works on a lot of subjects on this show.
Happy Valentine's Day, guys.
Thank you very much. Shelley and Kevin Chenoy, a married couple. They met at work at an international banking firm. And, of course, Takeaway Work contributor Beth Koblenzer. Thanks so much.
And Shelley and Kevin's romance, you can read some of the details on our website. We got both versions of the story. Check it out at thetakeaway.org in time for Valentine's Day. Do you have your own tale of workplace romance that went right or horribly wrong? We'd love to hear your stories at 877-8-MY-TAKE or on our site, thetakeaway.org. The First Lady will be on Good Morning America in a few minutes talking about childhood obesity. We're looking for your take on dieting. If you've lost weight, what's a tip you have for everyone? And part of the reason it's hard to lose weight is because of vices. What's your vice? Tell us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or post it to our website, thetakeaway.org. If you lose enough weight, you could have a good week. Okay, The Week magazine has Good Week, Bad Week. Stay tuned for that on Friday.
I'm Celeste Headley.
I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway. We'll be right back.
Thanks for listening to the Takeaway Podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.